Any questions or thoughts?
I'm just really taken by the idea that the problem with desire is not in the desire itself, but in the conflicting nature of desires in the plural. Yeah. I've just not, really thought of it that way before in explicit terms. It's really helpful. Yeah. I mean, I've had a kind of intuitive sense that that is the challenge of living, to kind of deal with the fact that these conflicts occur. But the idea that you can kind of don't need anything other than that recognition to engage with it. You don't need to sort of solve this problem of discriminating between positive craving and negative desire, negative desire and positive desire. You don't actually need to make that distinction. That's incredibly liberating, I think, recognizing that. And I don't think I've got my head around that before. That's quite an insight for me today.
I think that potentially ties in with the way we judge people as well. If you have this perspective that it's this person or that person, that it's just a lack of awareness of this conflict of desire, you can approach the way you relate to people from a less confrontational perspective. Saying that, no, you are evil, or you're thoughtless, or you're, I don't know.
Yeah, it's right. We have this tendency constantly to think of people as wholes, and I think that's the self view as applied to others, and hence label them there like that.
Yeah.
Actually, they have this bag of desires. Yeah, that's what's motivating them in the actions that we might react to.
Yeah, that's what I meant.
Yeah. I mean, people often say, you know, what if the desire is something terrible, like committing mass murder or abusing a child or whatever? You know, isn't that desire in itself bad because of its object? But I'd still say the problem with that desire isn't the desire, it's the fact that that desire conflicts in these cases in a profound way with the people you want to murder, and with obviously the child and the child's interests in the case of abusing a child, and indeed the rest of society's interests. And that would obviously have implications for how we'd treat something like paedophilia, because it's not the desire itself, it's the way that desire is focused and acted upon. And obviously there might be ways of diverting such desires, and hopefully there are, to make them less destructive for people.
I like this idea of the two energies, and instead of like with the mules not working against each other, working together, but I am struggling to see how that works in terms of something like addiction. And I know you sort of explained it, but I didn't really, it wasn't satisfactory to me. So I was wondering if you might, or someone might, say a bit more about how you could have, you know, the wanting to stop doing something and the addiction to it, how you could possibly make those things work together.
Well, I suppose you have to think about the desire for the thing you're addicted to separately from the object of that desire. So the that desire could potentially be focused on other things, which might, to start with, be any slightly different. So think about a heroin addict going on methadone. You know, that's only very slight progress, but it's very slight progress. And then maybe if that desire can then be moved from methadone to something even less harmful or addictive, and so on. That's where the incrementalism, I think, is crucial, because there's no way that addict is going to leap from addiction to non-addiction. But there are ways in which their desires can be slightly redirected by gradual changes in worldview, views about what is good for them and what would fulfil their desires. So part of that might just be moving from one substance to another, but it might also involve gradual increasing identifications with the wider picture, so what sort of effect it's going to have on the addict's life in the longer term, what effect does it have on other people the addict lives with, and so on.
So it's using the energy that would be directed at desiring the thing to try to think about it in that way.
Mm.
Okay.
Yeah. So, if you think about desire just as energy, you could see it in the metaphor of a river flowing down a channel. And obviously you can't just dam the river all at once, otherwise you just get a flood. But you can divert the river in another direction, and if you make enough preparations and dig the right channels, then you'll manage to get it eventually in a different direction.
You could arguably also combine it with the reflective aspect of experience and noticing that, for example, say it was smoking, that often the temptation is stronger when you are with other people, or how I gave up smoking the first time was I noticed that I have a fairly obsessive nature, so that obsessiveness was with smoking. I could smoke up to 30, 40 cigarettes at a weekend sort of thing. So I decided to run a marathon. And a lot of that energy was channeled into that, and it had to be fairly obsessive to do that. Well, for me anyway, and that gave me that 6 month hump, because basically I needed to train for a year. So that period of time, that was a good strategy. It stopped me smoking for 4 years and start again. But maybe that was some form of energy transfer. Energy, yeah.
Similar experience with smoking. I mean, my biggest struggle with addiction has been alcohol, and that's what got me interested in meditation and that sort of thing originally. That's over 10 years ago now, but funnily enough, I didn't have similar problems with nicotine. So I smoked quite a lot when I was in my late teens, but I was very into dancing. Well, I was a professional dancer, and I just noticed that every time I went home to stay with my parents, I stopped smoking because I didn't have, already decided to greatly reduce the amount I smoked, because I had to go out of the house and find somewhere secluded to smoke, because my parents didn't know I smoked. And then when I got back to training after the holiday, I noticed that despite the fact that I'd been sat on my arse for a week or 2 weeks, I was actually fitter cardiovascularly. I actually, my cardiovascular fitness had gone up through not training but not smoking. And so then I had this real kind of incentive to, I could sort of see the benefits of giving up, and that was a way, I suppose, that I was able to integrate this desire for smoking with my desire for being fit and healthy. But I suppose the question that you were asking there, Kat, about how integration works with addiction, I find the MVC model that we'll look at this evening quite helpful in that regard, because it talks about universal human needs. So rather than and distinguishing between needs and desires and values on the one hand and strategies on the other, so strategies for fulfilling those desires, and so alcohol or nicotine or cocaine or whatever is one strategy for fulfilling a certain set of needs, and if you can get to the underlying needs themselves, things become a lot clearer, and you can. So the actual, why are you actually drinking? Is it because you value peace or comfort, or the subjective feelings of warmth, or getting rid of inhibition, or whatever it is? There can be a whole raft of things. Mm-hmm. And you can start to think of other strategies that may... Because, of course, I mean, there's no... If there weren't downsides to drinking or taking cocaine, then it'd be fine. it's actually the problem is that they do conflict with other things that we value. And that was what drove me into AA and recovery, really, was not just the physical downsides of drinking, but this this value I have for autonomy. And it was just the most soul-destroying thing about addiction for me was lack of freedom. It's lack of choice. Mm. It's really confusing and really, yeah, horrendous.
Well, that's a really good process to go back and then go back one further. That ties in again with your thing that desires are complex things. But I often find, you know, there's some people, I say, I'm really angry about this, but what's beyond the anger? Is it frustration or is it fear or... Or sometimes, again, something within MVC, sometimes you have what's called faux feelings. You might say you're disappointed by someone, but that's, when you really think about that, that's more an evaluation of that person and what you're feeling. And it's really helpful to think, when I say I'm disappointed by that person, what's behind that? So it might be a sense of connection you're not having, or... whatever it is, there's often words like betrayed or rejected. They're not real feelings. They're accusations in a way. But we see them as feelings. And what's interesting about MVC is about actually developing a vocab or really getting an insight into what these words mean. And then that helps you with all this energy stuff.
I don't know if it's really related, but what you were saying just reminded me of something else. So apologize if it's not actually related, but something we were talking about, I don't know if you brought it to the table, about this idea of very often, like really weirdly often, the things that irritate us about other people are the things that we do. Like, so a really good example is... I get really irritated when people interrupt me. And I'm like, you know, just, why are people always... and then so when we were discussing this, and you're like, well, if you get irritated when people interrupt you, there's pretty good chance you're constantly interrupting people. And so after keeping that in mind, I did, and I thought about it, and it was true. I was constantly interrupting people and finishing people's sentences. So now whenever I come across something that what a housemate does or whatever, that I'm like, oh, that really gets on my nerves, I'm like, have a look, have a check, and I think you'll see. And I think that's just an interesting thing. I don't know how it ties into this, but...
But yeah. Why do you think something that you do is irritating when someone else does it?
Because of some self-awareness or lack of self-awareness of it.
But... opposed to something that then irritates you about another person that you don't do, that irritates you as, I mean, you can find a rationale for that, but wonder what's going on. Now.
I think it shines a light on something you're not happy about yourself.
Mm.
So you see them do something that you don't like because you do it and you don't like that you do it.
Yeah.
You'd rather you didn't.
Could this tie in with this idea, for example, that who's that guy in Scotland, the Catholic head of the church? He was very homophobic. And then it turned out. And they've done studies on homophobia. They've got these two sort of, got people, and they've done these experiments, questions where they're not overt questions about homophobia, but it might be, if your teacher... was gay, would you be comfortable that they were providing RE classes or biology classes to your children? So these subtle questions. And then they separated these two groups, and then they put these sort of measurers on the penises of these people and showed them people having intercourse, male and female, and then gay couples having sex. And with both types, when they were watching heterosexual sex, it was pretty even. And when the ones that didn't respond negatively to these homosexual questionnaires, when they saw homosexual sex, there was a certain rise, but, you know, because we're, it's not black and white either, but you know what I'm going to say, when the, the penis enlarged more than or as much as people who are overtly homosexual. So maybe that's something, yeah. Something with that. I think there's a bias there, isn't it? Is there something like, there's one of those biases of, that you, because you're scared about something in yourself, then you overreact.
Mm-hmm. Or you could just say it in terms of...
Maybe protest too much. Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah. You could just say in terms of repression and projection. So mm-hmm. So we repress the desire, you know, that doesn't fit in with our current egoistic model of the world. And then that repressed desire is still going on unconsciously. So we unconsciously project that onto something.
The energy is being suppressed, so it has to, like, burst out somewhere.
Exactly, yeah.
In terms of, I was thinking about the specific example that you used there, I was wondering, well, in terms of sort of integrating desires and maybe it's, you know, you react to similar conflicts externally as you experience internally. And so, I don't know, I'm just guessing and thinking, what could interruption be about? And it's maybe something to do with flexibility and being able to pick up on different, you know, respond to different trains of thought and that kind of thing. And you've got this tension between the value on the one hand of being able to be focused and consistent and stick with an idea or a train of thought, and this other need to be more respondent to conditions and contingencies and the way things change. And that's a struggle that's going on inside all of us to some degree or another. Mm. And so that conflict in you, when you find yourself frustrated because you think, I want you to finish your point about that, or I want to make, or I want to stay with that idea, I don't want you to go off, so I'll interrupt you. And then the similar problem with other people interrupting you, they're saying, you know, hang on, can you move away from what you're saying, what you're going on to next, and come back to what we were talking about before, or whatever. Similar kinds of conflict, right?
I feel like, when I'm thinking it's more maybe to do with patience and lack of patience. Like, I think when I interrupt, like, it's the worst with me and my housemate, that I think we're getting better at it, but yeah, I would tend to finish her sentence because I think I know what she's going to say, and I think she does the same to me, and it's irritating, so I'm like, that's not what I was going to say. Let me finish my sentence. But I'm sure, you know, I don't always know what she was going to say, but I still finish it. And it's because I'm impatient, because I'm like, we've got to get on with it, we've got stuff to do, you know, we've got work, there's work to be done, and, you know.
It'd be easier if you were German.
Well, I'm half German.
Well, well, it would be easy if you communicate in German, because the verb comes at the end of the sentence, so you can't, it's a lot more difficult to interrupt.